Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. At the end of World War II, Congress was quick to recognize the efforts of the U.S. code-breaking forces. They saved lives. Their work shortened the war. They broke the Japanese code, enabling the Navy to intercept and destroy practically every supply ship and convoy in the Pacific. As journalist and author Liza Mundy recounts in her new book, the fact that more than half of those codebreakers were women was nowhere mentioned. 70 years after the war, the records were declassified, and Mundy uses those documents and scores of interviews to tell the story. The book is entitled Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Liza Mundy.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to talk to you.
Why did the military wait 70 years to declassify the documents about the codebreakers?
Well, that's a good question. You'd think that World War II documents would have been declassified a lot sooner. But these were documents about code-breaking and cryptanalysis. The code-breaking operations ultimately became the NSA, the National Security Agency. And, you know, there is still concern about the proverbial sources and methods, particularly methods, because these women were decrypting enemy messages. They were basically stripping out encryption. They were hacking into enemy communication systems, and that is what the NSA does now. And I think, you know, there's always a great reluctance on the part of the intelligence community in Washington to release anything that might reveal any kind of method, even work that happened 70 years ago.
So what kind of documents were these? What did you get?
Oh, they are marvelous documents. They include rosters of women who were hired, women who came to work for the Army and Navy in 1942, or in some cases before that, but certainly in great numbers following the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. There are memos. There are internal histories. There are records of women's names, wonderful names from the 1940s, Miss Flo Beth Eniger, and names like that of women who broke major codes. It was just a much larger and richer collection of documentary evidence than I ever would have thought possible. I thought I would be spending about a week in the National Archives, and I stayed there for 3 months.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the female codebreakers during World War II. My guest is Liza Mundy. She's a journalist and author of a new book. It's entitled Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Women were more available than men during the war. Obviously, that's how we know about Rosie the Riveter and all of that in the factories. The military tapped the females for code breaking, though, because they were considered better at it. What was going on there?
Yeah, so there were a number of reasons why women were sought to do the brain work that was necessary to power the war effort. And this was true in private industry and defense companies, but it was very true in the government because Pearl Harbor exposed this massive intelligence deficit. We didn't have any of today's intelligence agencies. We needed to start intercepting messages right away that were traveling all over the globe, you know, thousands of military and diplomatic and political messages every day. So two things about women. They were available. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the men started shipping out and volunteering and being drafted right after Pearl Harbor. So the men were gone. Mm-hmm. So one thing was simple Expedia. There's actually a document I found in the archives in which the U.S. Navy literally puts into a document, new source of female intelligence officers, women's colleges. So availability of educated women was one, but it was also because women were thought to be better at tedious, low-level work. And the thing is, you know, there was a lot about code breaking that was tedious. It involved sorting, a lot of math, a lot of handwork. But the tedious, low-level work was eventually what would lead to the great breakthroughs. So whether or not women are more capable of doing, you know, careful, focused, meticulous work, I don't know. But they had to do it. But it was that tedious work that actually led to moments of breakthrough and major inspiration.
How much did the U.S. code-breaking operation change from, you mentioned the eve of Pearl Harbor, they had like, 118 people in the force, and by the end of the war, it was 20,000?
Right, exactly. But the Navy and the Army had sort of rival code-breaking operations that were competitive and cooperative, and they were hotly competing for women. And I know of code-breaking women being recruited from Ohio State. Certainly, they were coming from the Midwest as well as the Northeast and the South. But it grew exponentially. Like it's hard to convey how quickly this operation grew. There were a few hundred code-breakers before Pearl Harbor. Most of the Navy men had been trained by a woman named Agnes Driscoll, a mathematician. And actually, she was originally from Ohio, and she mastered the Japanese naval fleet code during the 1930s. The Japanese had changed their code books before Pearl Harbor, which was why we couldn't read those messages. But we knew how the system worked, and we were able to get back in not long after Pearl Harbor. And that's when the women really started flooding in. So they ramped up to the point where domestically we had probably 15,000 code breakers in the mainland, mm-hmm. and at least 11,000 of those were women. There were also men breaking codes in the theater of war, some women as well, but it was just a massive operation. It was an assembly line of code breakers.
When we hear about Bletchley Park, and I've talked with people about that before, in England, it was all one. It was all unified. The code-breaking operations were siloed in the U.S. What were the pros and cons of that? How did it happen in the first place?
Yes, Bletchley, the British were horrified by the interagency competition in Washington. I mean, World War II was, of course, when all sorts of agencies were getting started. Our military-industrial complex was blossoming. You know, the Pentagon was being built. The OSS, which would become the CIA, was being established. And just then, just as now, all of our agencies were vying for appropriations, for glory. They all wanted a piece of the code-breaking action. Somehow it just never happened that our code-breaking operation was consolidated into one. And I think that's a reason why it's not as famous as Bletchley Park. Mm-hmm. And whereas at Bletchley, the British were breaking the codes and then providing the information to all their military services. So they did consolidate it, you know, and that obviously worked very well. But it wasn't always a bad thing that we had our Army and our Navy competing with each other, because they were literally racing and competing to break code systems as fast as they could. And there were definitely times where the competition was a good thing. It was, you know, sort of egging, they were egging each other on.
Mm-hmm. And then the prospects for women at the time, let's set the scene there a little bit, because there had been, while women got the vote, the year that most of these women were born was the year that women got the vote, which is a very interesting little detail at the beginning of the book that kind of resonated with me. But by then, there'd also been the Depression. There'd been a lot of backtracking.
Right. This generation of women I've become so attached to. So just as you say, born in 1920, women get the vote. Everything looks great. The Depression hits when these women are 9 years old. And they grow up in households that are often really quite traumatized by the poverty of the Depression. And I interviewed more than 20, you know, living women who did the code breaking work and also had memories of their childhoods. And one of the things that I always asked them was, why did you go to college? The women who did go to college, and many of these code breakers did, mm-hmm. Because only 4% of American women completed 4 years of college in the early 1940s because their parents couldn't afford the tuition, but also because their parents didn't think it was necessarily worth it for a woman to go to college, because the only job she could count on when she graduated was teaching school. Other you know, aspects of the labor force were completely closed. Women are just about closed. You know, medicine, law, architecture, engineering, the sort of high-level work that a college woman today would aspire to was not available to these women. So suddenly, after Pearl Harbor, there was this incredible competition for educated women, and you know, the Army and Navy were competing, the defense agencies were competing, but it was sort of baked in from the start that the understanding that it would be temporary, mm-hmm. And there was one request made to Goucher College in Baltimore by a company that wanted female engineers, and it said, give us beautiful ones, for we don't want them on our hands after the war, the expectation being that they would then get married and, you know, and return. return to their regularly scheduled lives.
Yeah, and really one of the only things that you said was teaching, and which is explains why they hit up so many teaching colleges along the East Coast and, of course, down into the South.
Absolutely. And in the Midwest also, one of the women I interviewed attended Indiana State Teachers College, which is now Indiana University of Pennsylvania. And they also approached the great co-educational universities. As I said, they're in Ohio. I know of at least one codebreaker who was educated at Ohio State. So the Army it's so funny. The Navy was sending these secret invitations to women at the Seven Sisters School. The Army strategy was to send handsome young Army officers to recruit young college graduates, female college graduates and school teachers, to lure them to Washington with the expectation that they would make a marriage. And in fact, many of these women were actually eager to come to Washington to get away from mm-hmm. engagements and marriages that they didn't want to. And also to, you know, to see what Washington, D.C. was like, to get away from small towns or just, you know, familiar environments. In fact, the woman I know who was at Ohio State, she always afterwards talked about Washington as being where the horn blows, just because it was so exciting to mm-hmm. be able to come to the nation's capital at a time where Washington was really being established as the center of the free world.
You know, there was a subplot in the movie about Turin, the guy who broke the...
Imitation Game.
Yeah, Imitation Game, thank you. There was a subplot in there about the character played by, I should know her name, Keira Knightley,
uh-huh.
That her parents didn't want her going off by herself like that.
Right.
Was that a problem for in the U.S.?
Yes. Now, you know, and ultimately the WACs and the WAVES were created, and some of the women codebreakers joined
in
the
Navy.
Yeah, the Navy. And there was a lot of stigma at first for a woman going into uniform were considered to be bad girls, you know, that the idea that they were going into the military literally to sexually service the men. So several of the women I talked to said that their parents didn't want them to join. But then when they did, very quickly, their parents became very proud of them. In fact, one woman remembered being in her uniform for the first time, and she was running down the stairs at a train station to catch the train, and she distinctly heard a woman say to her husband, "Why? Some of them look like nice girls." So it was very sort of disconcerting, I think, for the nation to have so many women going off alone to live on their own, to work, to get on these trains and sometimes take, you know, a train trip of several days to get to Washington. It was very exciting for the women. But it was I found documents in which high-level government officials were clearly unnerved by the number of women who were in train stations crisscrossing the nation.
Why did the Navy decide to allow women to join the military, but the Army didn't?
Yeah, that's a good. So the Army did allow women to join the military. Women could become WACs and join the Women's Army Corps. But the big Army code breaking operation remained mostly civilian. They did have some WACs working there, but mostly the school teachers that the Army recruited remained civilians. I think they felt that there would be more flexibility. And in fact, what you see when you look at the documents is that women, even if they were just 22, fresh out of college, if they were really talented and smart, they would be directing units, doing cybersecurity, keeping our military communications safe, directing code-breaking uniform units. Some of the women at age 22 or 23 were put in charge of those units. So because it was a civilian operation, there was less hierarchy, and there was more flexibility in terms of who could be listened to and who could be put in charge. So I think that was good, and it worked really well and led to breakthroughs and good management. But the great advantage to the Navy women who were working the German and Japanese naval codes was that at the end of the war, they had access to GI benefits. And a number of the women that I talked to, A, stayed in the workforce, or B, went on to do graduate work and to get their PhDs and then rejoin the workforce. So the GI benefit, of course, it was an enormous benefit for men, but it was a real benefit that the Navy women availed themselves of.
We're talking about the women codebreakers of World War II in the United States. My guest is Liza Mundy. She's a journalist and author of a new book entitled Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. If you have a question or comment for Liza Mundy, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the code-breaking operations in the U.S. during World War II. More than half, well over half, of the 20,000 code-breakers employed by the U.S. Department of Defense were women. Journalist and author Liza Mundy writes about their history in her new book entitled Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Liza Mundy is my guest this hour. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Liza, you know, I got a million questions, but before we moved on, I wanted to establish that many of these women were certified brilliant people.
Oh, absolutely. As I said, you know, only 4% of American women went to college back at the time. These women were extremely motivated. They were, they were the top young women at their universities. So, and they made extraordinary breakthroughs both in the Japanese and the German codes. Their work clearly shortened the war and saved lives, and it was very stressful for them. I mean, they took this work so seriously. They kept the secret really for the rest of their lives, and they struggled a lot with both the stress and urgency of their work, and they were so conscientious that they would also focus on, you know, the men whose lives they couldn't save.
Once again, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's turn to Brent in Upper Arlington. Hi, Brent. You're on the air.
Hey. So I was wondering, one of the first really decisive victories for the United States in World War II was the Battle of Midway in I think it was June 1942. And a big part of that was the U.S. had broken the Japanese naval code and figured out what the signal was for Midway, what that meant, and that told them where the fleet was going. I wonder to what extent the women codebreakers that early in the war played a role in that.
That's a great question, and you're exactly right about Midway. It was early June of 1942, and it was seen as sort of payback for Pearl Harbor. The actual code breaking at that point was mostly done by male naval officers in the Pacific. The women from the Seven Sisters colleges were just streaming in to DC headquarters as that was happening. They had been secretly trained during their senior years of college, and the minute they graduated in 42, they came to Washington and started working. So they were there when Midway happened. They were just coming in. But the fact that we had diagnosed and were able to break that fleet code and understand that the Japanese were hoping to ambush us at Midway, that was thanks to this civilian naval genius, Agnes Meyer Driscoll, who had spent the 1930s as a civilian for the Navy diagnosing the changes in this great Japanese fleet code. It was called JN-25. And she was the one who sat at her desk day after day, year after year, learning how that code system worked and training men like Joe Rochefort and Thomas Dyer and other male naval officers who would then be sent to the Pacific and would be involved in Midway. And they all give her credit in their memoirs as being, they describe is one of the great cryptanalysts of all time.
So it was a woman, but it wasn't part of the women codebreakers, the surge after Pearl Harbor.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. I have a section of Agnes Driscoll in my book, and mm-hmm. she certainly taught the men who were doing it from June 4th through 6th, I think Pearl Harbor was. And at that moment, the much greater cohort of female codebreakers was literally pouring into Washington.
Thanks, Brent, for that question. Appreciate it. So the women who came in, you mentioned earlier that some of the parents ended up being very, very proud of their daughters for joining the military. But all things being equal, none of them knew what they were doing.
Correct. The women were told that that if anybody asked them what they did at these giant code-breaking compounds in Washington, which were guarded and enclosed by, you know, double bent wire fences, they were to say that they were secretaries. They were to tell people that they emptied waste baskets and sharpened pencils. And that's what they told people, and people believed them. Mm-hmm. People believed that because they were women, the work that they were doing couldn't be truly important. And in that way, you know, they were really the best intelligence officers, because people just assumed that the work would be low level that they were doing. And their families were proud of the women for being in the military, but the women could never tell their families what they were doing. And in some cases, the women I interviewed said, you know, my dad would have been so proud of me, mm-hmm. if he had known what I was doing, but, you know, I could never tell him. Although some of the women were able to tell their families that their brothers were safe. Some of the women were actually able to track their brothers' ships, you know, throughout the Atlantic and Pacific, and sort of keep tabs on them. But they could never tell their parents how they knew that.
Well, that brings up another issue. There was some discrimination in terms when they were first looking for this. I can't remember if it was the Navy or the Army that sent out, or it might have been a company that sent out specs. No this, no that, no Jewish women, no Polish
yeah.
women, that kind
right.
of, no Czechoslovakian women.
Right.
What was that all about?
Yeah, the Navy was, they were very concerned then as now about, you know, background checks and anybody who seemed to have, you know, some kind of sort of foreign connection. So the Navy in particular was very, it was snobbish in going after,
anyway.
You know, right. But it was particularly reluctant to admit women who departed from a sort of, you know, white Judeo-Christian WASP loyal background. Although the women who headed up the Seven Sisters colleges did volunteer up the names of Jewish women, and Jewish women did end up working in the code breaking compounds, and women who were second generation from different countries did. The Navy would not admit African American women into the code breaking compound, but the Army did. There was an African American code breaking unit in the Army code breaking compound
that was staffed mostly by African American women. There were also
exactly.
men there too.
Yep. And yeah. that was frustrating because the records are scanty on that unit, and what records exist mostly talk about the man, William Coffey, who was directing that unit, which is great. I mean, he had a really interesting personal life and backstory, but there was frustrating little information on the women who you can see in the photographs that it's mostly women working in that unit.
We're talking about the women codebreakers for the United States during World War II. My guest is Liza Mundy. She's a journalist and author of a new book. It's entitled Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the documents, the declassified documents that you found at the National Archives in Maryland. You said you planned on spending a week. You ended up spending 3 months going over those. What? Tell us about how you used them and where they led you.
Yes. What was so remarkable was, so I was interviewing, as I said, more than 20 women in their 90s who all remembered various aspects of their code-breaking work or their lives in Washington. And when you're a reporter or an historian, you always want to supplement verbal, you know, oral, remembered interviews with the paper record if you can. Mm-hmm. And I was worried at first that it might be hard 70 years later to be able to confirm what women were remembering, but it was remarkable what was there in the record. For example, I interviewed a woman who graduated from Smith College in 1942, and she vividly remembered the mathematical work that she did day after day at the working in the Japanese Naval Fleet Code, doing what they called recovering additives, which was stripping numerical encryption out of the intercepted messages to get down to the original numerical code group. She did this day after day. She showed me how that they did it. They were called additives. She talked about certain messages that they would look for called a shogoichi message, which was when a Japanese ship captain would announce to his superiors where he was going to be at noon the next day. A shogoichi message was a noon position message. Now, what better piece of intelligence for an American submarine commander than to know where a Japanese ship is going to be precisely at noon the next day? So when I started looking in the National Archives, not only did I find many memos about the additive work that the women were doing, many references to shogoichi messages. Not only did I find her name on the incoming rosters and her home address where she lived when she came to Washington, but I found these incredible memos that showed the war as after the Battle of Midway, when the Americans started pushing back to recover islands in the Pacific that had been captured by the Japanese to try to push their way back to the Philippines, the women were responding to every amphibious landing, every, you know, invasion of a Japanese-held island. And you would see memos in which they were told, you broke a record last week in the number of additives you recovered. This week you need to do better. You need to recover more. And then you would see messages saying, congratulations, you not only exceeded last week, but, you know, you broke your record. So it confirmed everything that she had told me. And that was the kind of documentation that existed. It was very surprising to me.
It became a race against time for you, right?
A race against time. That's why I interviewed the women first, before I had even been able to look much at the archives records, because these were women in their early to mid-90s, and I was definitely working on what I came to think of as an actuarial deadline. I wanted to get to them really whilst they were still alive. And the women were very realistic about this to me. One of the women I interviewed her in an emergency room in Atlanta because she had broken her wrist the night before, and she said, you know, I just hope I live to see the book published.
Yeah, they must have been pretty excited to talk about this stuff after all this time.
They were excited, but some of them were still reluctant. I mean, again, they had been told to keep a secret. They didn't realize that the vow of secrecy had actually been lifted in the 80s and 90s. Like, nobody had bothered to individually tell them that it was okay to talk. And so in some cases, I still had to talk them into it. But certainly they knew now that books had been written on code breaking during the war, that the women had largely been left out because they were so good about keeping the secret. And clearly, they would like to get some credit now for what they did.
How could books about code breaking during the war leave women out?
Exactly. I mean, and often the books that I read would sometimes mention in a parenthetical, literally a parenthetical, by the way, most of this work was done by women. And then it would go on to talk about the men who did the work. And I think two reasons. Again, the women weren't talking. They didn't know that it was okay to talk. But I think also there persists this idea that if women are doing or contributing to a major project like this, it has to be sort of as assistants or helpmeets or doing sort of low-level secretarial work. Mm-hmm. I just think that the historians writing about the war were assuming that the work the women were doing wasn't as important as the work that the men were doing. Not all historians, but certainly some of the big books, just they didn't talk to the women.
Well, one aspect of all of this that you mentioned was that the way they worked. There were a few hot shots out there, really famous people. You know, as we mentioned, Alan Turing, in the UK, and a few other notables. But the women worked like a hive. There weren't necessarily stars. They weren't competitive that way.
No, they weren't competitive. And a number of the women in this operation would go on to work for the NSA mm-hmm. after the war. And one of them rose to become the first female deputy director of the NSA. She was incredible. And in fact, her name is on a major internal office conference room at the NSA. I wish it was on the outside of the building. Mm. But one of the things that she said was, we were very collegial because none of us expected to continue doing this work after the war. We weren't competing for glory. And I should say the Navy men were, because they were career officers. But none of the women expected to make this a career. So literally, they just weren't competing. They were working together. And you mentioned Alan Turing. I do think also that, you know, we like these narratives of sort of lone eccentric, tragic, genius men. And I think the publishing industry and Hollywood tend to like these, you know, brilliant men, a beautiful mind, whatever. And it does plant in the public mind this idea that so much important work is done by lone geniuses. And I would like, you know, there are women also who are lone geniuses. I mean, Agnes Driscoll was a remarkable, largely lone genius. Mm-hmm. But during the war, most of this work was done as a collective, and people working together, people with really good memories, talking to each other. There's a scene in the book where a woman codebreaker is listening to two men sort of speculate about how a code system might work, and that if it did, a certain four-digit code group would appear. And she said, oh, I've seen that four-digit code group. You know, that's the central code group in this other code system. And so they were really working together to mm-hmm. do this work.
And that's what made them so good.
Right, right. Absolutely. I mean, it couldn't have been done by just a bunch of lone geniuses or a few lone geniuses.
I have an email from a listener says, this is an interesting start to hacking and with so few women in coding now. How many World War II women codebreakers went on to the National Security Agency? Do you know how many women are at the NSA now? The late Michael Ruppert wrote that his mom was in the NSA, as I remember.
Yes, and that's a great point. This was women in STEM also, because they were what these code-breaking operations were doing was hacking into enemy communication systems, exactly what the NSA does now. They were running machines that were early versions of computers. We haven't talked about the Dayton, Ohio operation
right.
to build the big bomb machines that were early computers, and women were very, very involved in that. But this was early STEM work. It was early computer work. It was early hacking. And, you know, I don't think anybody knows exactly how many women went onto the NSA afterwards, but it was a significant number. Generally, they ended up making their careers at NSA, not marrying, not having children, because that was really what led a number of women ultimately to drop out of the workforce. When you started having children in the 1950s, there were just no supports. And so I found in some of the civilian personnel records of some of the top female mathematicians, you know, I'm sorry, I'm resigning because I need to be home with my baby.
I thought it was interesting, though. I'm pretty sure it's what you wrote about, that the reasons why there was no support system that was like it was considered kind of communistic and anathema to
Absolutely. There was child care during the war
yeah.
for Rosie the Riveter and for the women doing the brain work to be able to stay in and do that work. The government provided child care for infants, for school-aged children, for toddlers, but that was immediately withdrawn after the war, and then child care began to seem, you know, like a Soviet, you know, raising children collectively, and we, of course, can't have that.
We're talking about the women codebreakers in the United States military effort in World War II. My guest is Liza Mundy. She's a journalist and author of the book. It's a new book. It's called Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the code-breaking operations in the U.S. during World War II. More than half of the 20,000 code-breakers employed by the U.S. Department of Defense were women. Journalist and author Liza Mundy writes about their history in her new book entitled Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to go back to one thing, though. The Axis powers did not mobilize women the way that the U.S. did, U.S. and Great Britain did, I should say. Why not?
I think because they were such traditionally minded societies, particularly the the ruling parties at that point. I mean, the Nazi attitude toward women, they did have some women in the military, but to my knowledge, they weren't using them for anything like this kind of high-level code-breaking. And they, you know, viewed women as breeders, basically, as receptacles, you know, to breed the master race. So the attitude toward women was very, very different. And even though, of course, we had sexism in our operations, our willingness to employ women in these high-level capacities was really, really important during the war. You know, it wasn't just that women took the place of men in factories and served as placeholders. These women codebreakers were enabling the military to develop military intelligence every day to know where the Japanese ships were going to be. There was a women's unit who was enabling the military, who was developing what they called order of battle every day for the Japanese army to know where the Japanese army was, to know where it was moving. They were doing this using traffic analysis and the radio address codes, and that was a totally female unit. So they were providing crucial military intelligence. They weren't just placeholders. They were helping to direct, you know, our military strategy. The Japanese women for this kind of purpose. Obviously, the Japanese, as we know now, had comfort women. They had sex slaves. So again, the attitude toward women and women's abilities was completely different in the Axis powers. And I think, you know, I think that's really important.
Now let's talk about Dayton. I want to get to that and what went on at that special operation. I thought it was kind of funny. I think you referenced it in the book that they thought they were on their way to California when they were put on the train. And then they wound up at woohoo, Dayton, Ohio, but whatever.
Right. They were told they were being sent west.
Yeah.
And they didn't know where that was, and they were envisioning palm trees, I think.
Yeah. So what did they do there?
Yeah, so this is also really important. I mean, we've talked about the Japanese naval codes and the Japanese army codes, but there was also the Atlantic Ocean, and there were the German U-boats that were preying on American convoys and sinking American ships, and it was very traumatic for the country. We've also talked about the imitation game, which is this moment, you know, where Alan Turing breaks the German U-boat code, but made by this Enigma, this famous Enigma machine that scrambled letters of messages. But what that movie doesn't say is that the Germans became suspicious, particularly the German Navy, and they changed the Enigma machine. They added a rotor that further scrambled the letters and that the British machines couldn't handle. So in Dayton, Ohio, more than 100, they called them bomb machines. It was bomb with an E. And they were built, a Dayton inventor named Joseph Desch worked with Navy mathematicians to design this machine, and there were female mathematicians on that team. And then there was a group of hand-picked women living at a place called Sugar Camp in Dayton, which had been owned by the National Cash Register Company. The bomb machines were being built. It was a top secret project in Dayton. The women were wiring and soldering the rotors that would turn, the wheels that would turn on these giant machines. And then most of the women were then secretly transported by train to Washington, D.C., where they would run the machines. And in fact, again, the people running that whole operation ultimately were women. It was women mathematicians who were doing sort of early algorithms to set up the machines. It was the women who had wired the rotors who were then running the machines, women who were breaking the daily U-boat messages, translating the messages, and writing up the intelligence reports that enabled us to completely clear the U-boats from the Atlantic Ocean.
The Dayton operation was a little different than what was going on in Washington. They were a little freer in Washington, right?
They had a wonderful time at Sugar Camp. They,
okay.
You know, they all these groups were working hard. They were on 24-hour shifts, so they might be working in the middle of the night. But the Dayton, the women at Sugar Camp just loved it there. It was like being at camp. They really enjoyed themselves.
Life, though, in Washington, D.C. was exciting.
They enjoyed themselves in Washington also. I mean, that's one of the sort of ironies. Even as though they were very stressed out by their work, they were very worried about their brothers and their boyfriends right. and their fiancés and their friends. But they had a great time in Washington also. I mean, it was, again, for most of these women, it was the first time they had ever had to get away from home and live on their own. They were dating wildly. There was a group of women in Washington who agreed that when they were out at bars, as they often were, if anybody ordered a vodka Collins, then they knew that somebody was asking too many questions about what work they were doing, and they were all to disperse to the ladies' room and then flee the establishment. So they actually had their own code words to sort of, you know, preserve their security and their secrecy. But they were, you know, they were going to clubs, they were going to concerts, they were enjoying the department stores in Dayton and in Washington, mm-hmm. going to restaurants,
and they had money. They were paid.
That's very important. They had money. They were paid, and they were often. This was charming. I mean, they were often writing, you know, half dozen or a dozen men, and they were sending snapshots to men. And there was one woman at Dayton who began corresponding with a soldier she had never met, and they corresponded for the entirety of the war. And when he came home after flying sorties at D-Day and elsewhere, you know, the what you would hope, they were engaged within a couple of days and had a very happy marriage.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Liza Mundy. Her new book is entitled Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. How many of these women are left?
That is also a good question. So I found more than 20. But, you know, since my book has been published, and actually even a little bit before, I've started hearing from families saying either, oh, I had a mother or grandmother who did this work, or in some cases saying, actually, my mother did this work, and she's still alive in an assisted living facility, wherever. And mm-hmm. so it is frustrating, you know, to find out about this after the fact. I feel like I could have continued reporting it for a year. But at a certain point, you have to say, you know, time's up, pencils down, time to write. So there were more than 10,000 women doing the work. Most would be in their early to mid-90s. But the women I interviewed were very you know, their minds were still very sharp, and they were in pretty good health. So they're bound. I would think that there would still be hundreds who were alive.
Tell us a little bit more about the stress of the job, because, you know, there's a lot of stress in a lot of jobs. But for some women, it's really hard to imagine when you think about that they come across information that could affect a relative, a fiancé.
Yes, as I said, some of the women were able to track their brothers' ships and tell their families that they were safe, but some of the women had the opposite experience, in the sense that they, one woman in the book was a watch officer, a naval watch officer, the night they broke a message saying that her brother's ship in the Pacific was about to be kamikazed, and there was nothing they could do to stop a kamikaze attack, mm-hmm. and the ship was, in fact, attacked, and she thought that her brother was dead, because most of the men were, and that was, of course, enormously traumatic. She continued doing her work because that was all she could do. And in fact, in that case, it later emerged that her brother was one of the few who had survived. But it was so stressful. And the women were told, if you make a mistake, somebody could die. So even if the work was tedious, even if they were tired, they were very aware that they had to be so careful. And even as they were working fast, they had to be careful and not make a mistake. And they were very aware that lives were at stake. And they were privy to, you know, sort of the full the enormity of what was happening in a way that the American public was not, because the newspapers had a lot of propaganda in them. I mean, mm-hmm. the newspapers were trying to sort of cheer up the American public, and the women knew the truth of, you know, the cost even of victories.
We have an email from Susan. She writes, my mother, Jane Ellen Alsop, and in parentheses, Rising, was a codebreaker. We still have her cryptography wheel. She mentioned being held there 3 days until they broke the Japanese code. She never gave details beyond that. She left Vassar before graduating to join the team.
Vassar was a great source of women mathematicians. I mean, Vassar also gave us a woman mathematician at the time, was Grace Hopper, who is a pioneer of computing. She was teaching math at Vassar, and she went with the Navy and was responsible for helping write the first computer programming language. Her name is now on an academic college at Yale. And a lot of these women codebreakers from Vassar suspected that Grace Hopper had identified them for the program. I don't know if that was the case of the mother of your listener, but Vassar was a treasure trove of women mathematicians for this project and other naval projects.
Okay, I'm going to turn to Linda in Westerville. Linda, hi, Linda, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have great aunts and aunts who all went to Washington, D.C. during World War II and became secretaries. And yet later on, I used to think, oh, you could have done so much more. How do I find out if they were actually codebreakers? They're all gone now.
You can do this. Okay, so on my website, which is lizamundy.com, I have a page that is resources for families, and you can easily obtain a person's civilian or military personnel record during the war. It's a matter of public record. I have instructions for how to do it, and if you do obtain those records, if you want to email me also through my website, I can help translate them for you. If it says that she was a cryptanalyst, clerk or something, I might be able to tell you what that title actually meant.
Thanks a
lot. Because they probably weren't just secretaries.
Yeah. We will put that website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And Linda, thanks for that call. How did you decide on the women that you did focus on for the book?
So, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I was looking for women who were integral or, important to different aspects of the project, Japanese Army, Japanese Navy, German Navy. It also sometimes depended on how much information I was able to get about a particular woman. There was the central character in the book, Dot Braden, who was a school teacher in Chatham, Virginia, overwhelmed by her teaching load, recruited by one of those handsome officers, came to Washington. She is still alive, and I was able to have 20 interviews with her and also get really quite a good paper record of her service. So sometimes it had to do with just who I could get the most information on.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also looking for women who were pivotal to certain aspects of the code breaking operation. It was there was so much more information than I had even thought there was going to be. It was sometimes hard to choose.
Pat in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Pat.
Yes. I just wanted to point out that how close this book could be. It could be a companion to a book we read in a book club called Girls of the Atomic City. I don't know if the author is familiar with that book, but it was all of the things that the girls did in Tennessee that contributed to the atomic bomb. And they didn't even know the whole time they worked on it, the whole time they were working in food services and in the hospital and et cetera, et cetera. They didn't know in Oak Ridge that they were really contributing to the atomic bomb, but they did so much for the war effort. And I think it could be a companion to the book that the author is discussing.
Okay.
Yes, I do know about that book. And incidentally, the reason that a number of our books have girls in the title is because the women were always referred to as girls. Mm-hmm. And I saw that over and over again in the record. So it's a bit of an ironic usage on our part. But I do think that there's a crop of books out now. And of course, Hidden Figures,
right,
about the African-American female mathematicians at NASA is also one of these. I'm going to be on a panel with that author.
Oh,
and I do think it's so important that these books are all coming out because I think there's a new receptivity among readers and people in general to believe that these women really were integral to these projects. I think that all of these books and movies can work together to fill out the historical record and supplement each other to confirm that this really did happen and that these women really were important. And I think that if these records had been declassified maybe 20 years ago, mm-hmm, and I had written this 20 years ago, I'm not sure that people would have been as willing to receive the message. I think there's a more willingness now, thanks to books like the one that your caller mentioned.
Well, thanks to you, Liza Mundy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Liza Mundy is a journalist and author of a new book. It's entitled Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. And if you go to our website, we'll have the link to her website there if you want to check that out to learn more if you know someone you think might have been a code girl, a code breaker during World War II. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.